Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm the net control operator for this Limon Technical Net. Limon Technical Net has been going strong for almost 43 years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we all get together, and hopefully we learn from each other and are entertained by each other. So I hope everyone has joined again this Sunday night, and I hope we have a good technical match. It really is dependent upon you people out there, what topics you would like to discuss, what questions you might have, what answers you might hold. So it's always a mystery until it's over. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you my usual link. Okay? If you need to reach me, and you can't do it by the radio, then email is as good as any. That would be either for what we used to call mailbag questions, questions that you'd like to ask during the technical net, but for one reason or another can't be near a radio transmitter to ask it. You might be listening in either on a radio or on our internet stream, or you might listen to an archived copy later on in the week that's going to be available. So you can ask your questions in email form, and we'll try and answer them, and you can listen in for the answer. Also, topics for discussion. Sometimes people will volunteer to do a short discussion on a topic that they're well-versed in, share it with us. Sometimes people would like to be part of a discussion about a certain subject, and other times some people don't know that much about the subject and would just like to hear a bunch of people talking about it. They would prefer more passively to listen. Also, if you have any technical puzzles, we're always looking for technical puzzles. They're usually things that can't be answered with Google in a fraction of a second, because the journey to the destination of the answer, in my opinion, tends to be more important than the actual destination. So someone kind of quickly keys and reads off their Google answer, and it kind of blows everything up. Or if you have a topic for discussion for Paul, NASA or space related, we got one this week and I forwarded it to him. You can either send it to him directly at spacenetreport@gmail.com, or you can send it to me. My email address is mailbag@at2gs.com. We also have a link page. When I read interesting articles of technical nature, I cut and paste them on a list, and I put them up every week, and so hopefully a few people find it entertaining and informative. It links to articles, so it's always up there 24/7, so it's at roy.ac2gs.com. Again, you just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you my weekly link page. Let me drop for a second. Okay, we have a chat room. Lately it's been rather quiet. But, you know, it's subject to getting loud and boisterous. You know, these things come and these things go. If you would like to check out our chat room, the quickest, easiest way is to simply type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to our chat room. We also offer an audio stream on the internet of the technical net. You can just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you an audio stream. I used to have it only for the technical net, but some people asked if I could keep it up for the rest of the week, so it's a sort of a 24/7 connection to the Glen Oaks repeater. If you don't have a radio, you're not in radio range of it. If you have internet access, you type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com and it'll send you an audio stream. I also always like to remind people my KC2NJI has an archive site called amateurradio.tv. He's had over a million visitors, and he keeps archives of our technical net that go as far back as September of 2006. So please avail yourself of those archives. A lot of smart hams who either moved away from the area or have unfortunately become silent keys are reported, their wisdom on these archives. So take advantage of it. The laws of electrodynamics do not change in 10, 15 years. So that's a very useful point. Let me drop for a second, and I'll be right back. Okay. Well, we're going to ask for questions. Questions or comments or topics, whatever. And I would prefer if the first few people up on the list have amateur radio-related questions, because this is theoretically an amateur radio technical net. We will explore other aspects of science and technology. I'm not afraid of it. But people tend to like to first hear about antennas and radios and such at the beginning of the technical net. So I will ask for people to hit that push to talk and give me their first name and their call sign. I'll put them on a list, and we'll go down the list, and we'll take their questions or their comments or topics for discussion. So please, I hope you'll participate. That's what makes or breaks these technical nets. You know, I've listened to some technical nets where the poor guy just keeps talking to himself, and that's not fun. So with that in mind, I will call for questions or topics or comments tonight from the people listening out there. Hit that push to talk. Hit that push to talk and give us your first name and your call sign.
WA2VDH, John, you have a question regarding RIDI.
KD2VHD,
one question, ham radio, and some others not.
John, Jim, and Wesley recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list?
KD2VHD, Jim. Did I get in there, Roy?
Yes, indeed. I have John, I have Jim, and I have Wesley.
NQ, when you, John.
Okay, John number two. Recognize anyone else here to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, I'm not sure if that was a check-in or to be on the list. It just came across as a background noise. So if someone was transmitting after John did, maybe reposition the antenna, put it closer to the window, or if it's horizontal, make it vertical. You know, there are different ways of improving gain and decreasing the background noise. So if that was an attempt, please try again. Okay, nothing heard. Well, hopefully later on there'll be some more action on top of the four people who already checked in, which I'm glad to see. John, WA2VDH, what's your question about RIDI?
Yeah, my question was, where is it all going? I remember a couple of years ago I used to hear a lot of mTOR Mode A, you know, the one that sounds like a cricket, the chirping. I used to hear that all over the place, and I used to hear a lot of that on the commercial stations like WLO down in Mobile, Alabama. You don't hear any Mode A Sutor or Amtor anymore. The only tour station I hear now is occasionally I copy Navtex on 518 kilohertz with Sitor Mode B, the forward error correction one. So I just wondered what happens. Is it like it's dropped out of favor? I know I do hear a lot of WSTJ, Week Signal Joe Taylor stuff on 14075. I guess that's the current one that's popular. But I just wonder what happened. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's an unfortunate case that familiarity breeds contempt. There haven't been any real technological advancements in packet radio or RIDI. A lot of the latest, greatest technology is available to most people. The Joe Taylor suite of software, but particularly FT8, as you mentioned, the frequency where FT8 is located is always bouncing. Everyone and their brother is making contacts all over the country and the world.
You don't need a great deal of power. It operates below the noise floor. And these things have become so ridiculously automated. There are robots that you could just set up your computer and your radio, and then you can take a nap for the rest of the day. And when you come back, you'll get a Works All State certificate for your efforts, if any. So that, I think, is the problem. Riddy is popular every so often when there's a contest. If there's no contest, there's no activity that I could discern. And Tackett, it kind of came and it kind of faded away. There are people who are trying to get new technologies to somewhat be similar to Tackett. There's something called Ribbit out there, which is a technology to piggyback text transmissions off of repeaters and other systems. That's going to hopefully have some kind of renaissance to text. But, you know, I think people are just kind of moving on to new technology. And FT8, if there's one thing it can do, is it can fill out your log list of places that you've never contacted before.
Yeah, and it's that's interesting. And it seems to also be mimicking, even in the commercial frequencies. I remember 10, 15 years ago, I used to hear a lot of other modes of RIDI, like these ARC modes, ARC-E and ARC-MOR, which are used commercially by foreign military. I know the French Navy used to use a lot of these ARQ modes, and you don't hear much of that anymore. Probably they all have gone to satellite. And another mode I used to hear a lot of that has vanished, if you remember those signals that sounded like buzz saws on the HF band, I think those were voice frequency telegraphy signals. They were like half a dozen or more very narrow shift RIDI signals all running together, right? Because the decoder I have, I could separate off one or two of them. Most of them were encrypted, but occasionally you'd come across an AT news feed.
A couple of years ago, I
bought this universal decoder that does all these strange modes, and I used to get a kick out of watching traffic from various stations. Sometimes I even copied QE2 on Sitor. But it's all gone now. It's all gone. Go ahead.
Duane.
Yes?
I remember asking about AMTOR a while back, and I pretty much got the same answer. It really, I think it went away like 20 years ago. But, I still have the TNC, the terminal node controller. And like you said, that was, you listen to the chirping, and you can watch the LEDs coming together when they open, when they were in the middle, when they lined up. Then you had a link, and it was a link directly with one station. Somebody else couldn't chime in. You were connected with that one station only. But then I put it away for I don't know how many years, and I bought it back, and I noticed the same thing. AMTOR was, as far as I was concerned, was gone. Anyway, back to you, Roy, WS2N.
Yeah, AC2GS. The problem, among many other things, with Tackett is became proprietary. I think the Class 1 was not, but then the company that brought out Class 1 brought Class 2 and Class 3, and they were all proprietary, and you had to buy from them, and there was a heavy markup. And there's one thing hams really dislike is proprietary protocols. So, Tackett was sort of the Me Too of the Internet, I think, and I think hams kind of grew, not that thrilled with the Internet in that way. So it just kind of sort of faded away. Now, people have tried to one-up on FT8.
One of the complaints of people who like to rag chew, and FC8 is certainly not a rag chew mode. It's a contact mode. You know, if you want to make a contact, exchange a little bit of information, it's wonderful. If you want to have a conversation, lots of luck. But they tried. There was a third party that used the open source material, and it's called JS8Call. They expanded the text field, allowing you to have conversations, but because of the incredibly slow symbol rate of FDA-type transmission, it takes you forever to ask a simple question. So although JS8 is out there, and they do have JS8 kind of semi-contest, I don't think that it has anywhere near the pull that FDA does. It's just that anyone who's at all interested in any computer-based digital stream tends to be hanging out at the FDA fan.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I have noticed that, as I say, about the only tour mode I hear now, and this is in a commercial frequency, is NavText, which it's broadcast from several Coast Guard stations on a rotating basis. They go out at 518 kilohertz, and that's CITOR mode B, which is the continuous one. It's a forward error correction mode. And I copy that occasionally, and that's usually, you know, just notice to mariners and warnings about military practice in certain areas and stuff like that there. But, yeah, I guess these modes come into vogue and go out with popularity as time goes on. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind all of the television simulation modes that kind of have faded away. There's slow scan still. Every so often, as a lark, I'll set things up for slow scan reception. And it's usually the same, probably five guys who are just sending Korean War postcards back and forth to each other. It's kind of culturally amusing to watch. You know, people do sometimes get stuck in certain modes, but the overall number of hams kind of gravitates to the next great thing. So, you know, it's unfortunate that a lot of, because there are a lot of digital modes. If you've ever gone through these Swiss Army knife versions of software, there are laundry lists of different binary protocols available that are seldom, if ever, used these days. So it's sort of a shame, but it's the nature of technology. As things move on, it's the new shiny things that people gravitate towards.
Yeah, fine business, bro. Yeah, I know what you mean about these various other reading modes. I've looked up some of them. There's a mode called Piccolo, which is MRE, or multiple frequency shift keying, and it sounds just like a piccolo when you listen to it. Then there's a Hellscriber. There's literally hundreds of them. I remember Universal Shortwave, they came out with a number of decoders that would do some of these strange modes. And one of them was the M7000. I had that. And I remember copying some of these modes several years ago. A lot of them were used by foreign military groups. I know the French Navy used a lot of these ARC modes, ARC-4, ARC-E, ARC-E3. As I say, there's a whole bunch of them. Some of them have error correcting capabilities and stuff like that. But I know on HF you used to hear these signals idling sometimes for hours. And so I sat on one of those one time, and it was mostly idling, and then occasionally you'd see an ID that would indicate where it was originating from, usually somewhere in the French Caribbean or something like that. So anyway, just wanted to see if others notice the same thing. Okay, back to Ned.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I mean, there was Oliver. There's PSKs. They started PSK 32 and they worked their way all the way up for phase shift keying. Yeah, there are lots and lots of modes. Every so often, if I was listening to some strange signal and I had no clue what it was, and there are websites that actually have sound samples so that you can play the individual sound sample and you can theoretically teach yourself how to recognize what a signal possibly might be. But if you had to run through every permutation available on some of these software items, you could spend an hour just kind of shifting from one to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. So, it's a shame. I mean, there's a lot of them out there. I think none of them are quite as robust as FT8 and FT4, but the price that you pay is the symbol rate needs to be slowed down, and you need to have a very good time standard. But the important thing to me is the symbol rate is so slow that if I was to have a version of the conversation that we're having tonight, the last minute or so of our conversation would probably take about 20 minutes to do on JS8 call.
Well, that's how they achieve that. That's how these modes achieve their very low error rate. Is so much redundancy is built into them that you can actually dig below the noise floor. It's the increase in redundancy that achieves the low error rate in spite of a bad signal to noise ratio. But yeah, it's interesting to see how these various modes come and go. One of them that has always fascinated me, because I remember hearing it even as a kid when I first started listening on HF, was these modes that sounded like a buzzsaw. You used to hear this sound as you tuned across the HF spectrum. And I always wondered as a kid what that was, and then I found out that was called voice frequency telegraphy. They would run about 12 or 16 very narrow shift gritty signals together, like a shift of maybe 70, 80 hertz. And they would all be separated just by a couple of 100 hertz, and they would all be running simultaneously. So these transmitters were carrying many, many channels of gritty. Some of it was military encrypted stuff. But as I say, this decoder I had, it could dig into one of those. And usually you would find somewhere buried in there, you'd find an Associated Press news feed, or you'd find some other news feed. But most of the stuff was encrypted military stuff, which now I think runs mostly over satellite. Go ahead.
Yeah, that would probably be a more secure method. In addition, one of the aspects and the reason why FT8 is so good is the low symbol rate, but to compound that, they also have redundancy. So not only is the symbol rate low, but there's a lot of redundancy built into it. So that even effectively slows down the symbol rate to be even lower. So, and it also has a lot of clever error correction algorithms and all kinds of fun stuff. I mean, you know, it's caused a bit of a schism among moonbound people, because in the old days we would have people like Barry at MB set up these big arrays and these large amplifiers, and now guys with much smaller setups and digital, some digital algorithm will be able to bounce the moon. So, fascinating technology. It's a little too sterile for me personally. I've played with it, but it's not terribly rewarding. I've had some people sitting in the chat room doing FT8 while they listen to the TechNet, and at the end of the technical net, the guy told me that it just didn't feel like fun. I mean, really not a challenge if you could sit and listen to a broadcast or a net and do some kind of a contest simultaneously. But yeah, you know, whatever floats one's boat. It's incredibly popular. I have never gone to the usual FT8 frequencies and seen it quiet. It's always active.
Yeah, that's true, Roy. Yeah, I've even noticed some activity with that even on 10 meters. 10 meters seem to be getting more and more hot these days. So, yeah, it's a popular mode. And, yeah, the redundancy and everything really digs down there under the noise floor. Okay, Roy, thanks for the comments. I'll turn it back to you for the next person. WA2BDH, bye.
Okay, very good, John. Jim, KD2VHD, what's your question or topic for tonight?
Good evening, all. What a very interesting topic that was. I especially like to hear about the redundancy and how that related to what worked in those modes. Very interesting. My question is on another obscure and arcane mode that I realized I had the equipment to make run, and I threw it together, and I'm curious if there's any feedback on if I'm wasting my time. I've set up a station with a couple oddball little pieces of hardware, so I'm able to be on 2 meter single sideband, upper sideband, and I'm right now on 144.2. And it's an old school kind of thing, and I was looking for some feedback. Am I wasting my time? Is it interesting? Is it useful? I've got a 2 meter horizontal dipole up at about 14 feet, so it's highly limited, I assume. So I was looking for some feedback on that type of thing.
Okay, Jim. Again, this is AC2GS. I don't think you wasted your time. SSB 2 meters is done by more than a few people that I know. It is certainly more of a challenge than the standard use of repeaters because they're always there. And when you're dealing with single sideband 2 meters using horizontal polarization, you might reach some guy, you might not reach some guy. So, but everyone tends to like a challenge sometimes. So I see nothing particularly wrong in it. Again, the more power you can throw, the better. Usually people who do single sideband on 2 meters usually have themselves a bit of a linear amplifier to kind of give them a little bit more power, but 2 meters is, with the exception of ductile, modes of weather inversion, it's always a point-to-point contact. So the higher you can put up the aerial, the better your chance of getting some guy far away who put up a high aerial as well, so you can have conversations. So it's more challenging, it's more technologically involved, but it can be loads of fun. And if other people out there who have either the same opinion or a different opinion want to voice out on it, please feel free to hit that push to talk.
BDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I have the TR-751, which does single sideband as well as regular FM and CW, for that matter, on 2 meters. I have never tried it. I don't have much of an antenna up for 2 meters as far as the low end. All I have is a small little vertical. But I've been told that if I get something decent up, that there is some interesting activity with 2 meters or a single sideband, that you get some occasional interesting effects like tropospheric ducting and things like that. So I think it's well worth the investment of looking into it. I know Dick used to talk about it quite a bit on a single sideband or two.
Yeah, he actually had I think it was a nightly schedule with some guy. I believe there was some kind of a story about how he would bounce his signal off of a water tower because there was an obstruction otherwise. If you were serious about single sideband, you might want to consider a Yagi and a rotator to kind of improve your directionality. That's a very common configuration that single sideband 2 meter people use.
interesting. I don't picture a rotator in the mix here, but I could manually do it, and it would fit into the operation I'm doing here. It's worth considering. Sounds like something fairly straightforward to put together.
Yeah, it's you're trying to kind of direct the most power. Once again, the height is probably the most important thing to the equation, because every so often someone will mention that a guy flying a plane overhead is having a conversation, and the guy is getting farther and farther and farther away, and he's still hearing the conversation. So elevation is your first order of priorities or something like that. But as an aside, a decent, when you get to 2 meters and such, something like, I even use a 10-element Yagi, just I have it oriented vertically for another repeater in the area. But, oriented horizontally, manually rotated or electronically rotated, depends upon your circumstances, gives you a little bit more room.
It seems like an interesting thing to play with, and I was wondering, anybody else with some feedback? Have you done it before and made contacts? I listened to a QSO the other night. I think it was coming out of New York City, but I wasn't able to get to them. I would imagine they're more set up than I am. Any other feedback?
Well, anyone out there want to give Jim... any of your fish stories of how far you got and how consistent? I mean, once again, Dick used to have a regular, I think, nightly schedule with another gentleman using 2 meters. So I know it's possible. Anyone with any stories for us?
Glenn?
Yes, Walt.
I haven't done it, but I've heard that when you're on VHF contest is supposed to be very active. And Dick used to talk about he had a car. He used to talk to people going. He used to drive up to Utica, New York, all the time. He used to tell that story and talk to people on VHF 2 meters. You might remember that, Roy.
Yeah, I do. Good times. I don't know how active it's been lately. I haven't really had the opportunity. I have kind of a dearth of antennas these days, so they're kind of locked on to specific purposes that I haven't listened to. But I have a next-door neighbor a couple blocks away who at one point or another was deeply interested in single sideband distance 2 meter contact. I think he had to take his antenna down because the person who owned the co-op was doing something on the roof. But, it's alive and well. It's operating. It requires slightly different setup. So, if most of us are kind of optimized to repeaters, and that's probably the worst type of setup to use for a single sideband. The polarization is wrong. The power output is wrong. And sometimes the gear is wrong. Like I said, it's an interesting, challenging thing. You don't have to have a rotator. You don't have to have the highest antenna. It's a challenging thing. And if you find it enjoyable, there are other people out there who are trying to make contacts as well. So eventually you will bump into them.
Well, it sounds like it's not a waste of time. I'll continue to dabble. Thank you very much for the feedback. One comment before I go. I'll let it drop for a second.
And WHSCDL with a comment.
I can't say that I'm an expert in this at all. I just happened to read some commentary about the AI thing that you were talking about, Roy, the chat AI. I forget the name of it exactly. But from what I understand, it's, let's just say, more opinionated than you or I. And that's a statement. So I'd rather listen to you than that. So just a comment. Nice job tonight. Good stuff so far. KD2BHD listening to a great net.
WHCDL with boy information.
Yes, Andy, please.
Yeah, Yeah, occasionally I'm on 2 meter sideband. Not often, no. These days, it's better at the summit because you get that, I think John said, tropospheric ducting is a good thing. You have a nice beam up with many elements. You could get quite far. I have a small five-element horizontal beam for 2 meters on my tower, I guess, which is up around 50 feet or so. And I have the ICOM 9700, which runs dual mode, UHF, VHF. And 1.2 gigs. Don't forget, you know, we do have a 1.2 gig repeater, which is very rarely used, but it does work. So, the comment is, Jim. Let me just get the names right. Jim, if you want to write this down, 14429. 14429 is there's a group of sidebanders that operate on that frequency from New Jersey that I hear all the time. I worked one of them at one point without too much difficulty. My radio runs 100 watts. That's the maximum power. And I don't remember what power I had it set for, but they heard me without any trouble, especially on sideband. 14429 is a frequency that you can listen in, and you'll hear a bunch of sidebanders that are on from New Jersey. I forget their calls, so I just thought I'd add that in. Back to you, Roy, WH Studio.
Thank you, Andy.
Thanks, Andy. I'll listen to that. Thanks for the feedback. Very interesting. KD2VHD, thank you again for the info. I'll be listening.
Yeah. And one more thing before I forget. Most of the sideband is on 2 meters, and UHF operate horizontally polarized as opposed to vertically polarized. And so it would be better if you had a horizontal beam or horizontal dipole. You'll be able to hear them much better, and of course they'll hear you also. So I just thought I'd add that in. I was mentioned before, I'm just repeating it. Okay, WHCDL, I'm in the car, I'm just heading back to the house. Back to you, Lord.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Andy. This is AC2GS. Just touching very lightly, I'm not going to have any major discourse on artificial intelligence. It is becoming a major kind of issue in a lot of different aspects of the world. No doubt you'll still hear about ChatGPT and things that are a lot like ChatGPT. Those are artificial intelligence systems that are trained and optimized for conversational interactions as opposed to fact-giving, because as I mentioned before, ChatGPT is designed to be very agreeable and very polite and not to disagree with you. You can tell it that 2 plus 2 is equal to 17, and ultimately it will accept that and deal with it as best it can. There are other artificial intelligence systems that are trained completely different. There are a lot of graphic design. Artificial intelligence is where you enter a series of text and or a copy of a picture, and you can send it a picture, and you could say, I want the guy in the middle to have a clown's hat and a clown's red nose, and I want the backdrop to be in the desert. And just by describing it, it will synthesize an image. So that's graphic artificial intelligence. This past week, I've experimented with another type of artificial intelligence. These synthesizes voices. You can record a minute or two or three of a person's voice, enter it into a certain server, and it will give you a reasonably good facsimile of that person's voice. So, ultimately, in the future, don't believe anything that you see, that you hear. You know, it can all be synthetic. But it's still fascinating to understand, and if you don't understand it, then you're probably going to be victim to it a lot more than if you don't understand it.
Agreed, a very good size up. I agree. I'll reiterate, I am here to talk to you and use, and I have no interest in talking to a machine. I'm using a machine to talk to you and use. That's just my feeling, just my own little thing. But thanks for feedback on it, Roy. Very interesting.
Well, like I mentioned, either last week or the week before, I don't intend to retire and put it in the hands of ChatGPT. Although I guess theoretically you could use that voice cloning technology and the GPT, and it would sound like I'm still running it. But I will not do that to any of you poor people. So thank you again, Jim, for participating. Wesley, I guess you're next. What's your topic for tonight, Wesley?
Thank you very much. And to agree, and well, one is ham radio related, easy one. If I'm making a VHF quarter wave ground plane antenna, can I make cone from the sheet of metal to use as a ground instead of radio?
Sure, there's nothing that stops you from doing it. It's a little bit extra unnecessary metal, but theoretically the whole idea of a radial is to replace a insulating mirror plane in which the reflection of the monopole produces a virtual dipole on the other side. So because of the nature of RF, you don't have to fully fill it out with conductors. But if you wanted to, you could. And in the same way that you have radials for some designs that are going at 45-degree angles, you can connect the radials into a cone and use that as a ground plane. So I see no problem.
Yes, I do agree. There's a rapid diminishing return as the gap is between radials become short with respect to the wavelength. Basically, the radial mesh gets tighter. It looks more and more solid at the target frequency, which would be 2 meters. I think it is overkill to make a solid sheet of metal, but it would work. It is mathematically better, I assume. Measurably, not so. Am I right?
U.S. to end?
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, there was an antenna I used to have, isopole, and well, it wasn't quarter, it was 5/8, and it had two cones, two sheet metal pieces, you know, one above the other. It really worked very well, but again, it's not quarter. Back, you're right.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, if you were operating RF at a very, very low frequency, the spaces between the radials would obviously undermine it. But at most of the frequencies that we operate on, you just need three radials at 180 degrees to each other to give you a decent effect as if you had a sheet of metal. There's very little loss involved and a lot less material and mechanical strength required. So, yes, you could use a cone, and it would work probably better at very low frequencies, which you'd have to scale up all the other dimensions, though, so it would be a mechanical nightmare. But you can get by without it, which is a good thing, because it makes our 2-meter, 70-centimeter antennas much easier to deal with.
The other one is a little bit more complicated. Not much. What is the difference between monopole antenna, vertical antenna, and dipole vertical antenna?
I'll have it.
Yes, you Paul doubled with you. Paul, what did you want to say?
Okay, I put it into the computer, and sure enough, the pictures come up of the isopole with the two cones, exactly what I used to have. Back to you, Ernest.
Okay, very good. Getting back to what you said, Wesley, What's the difference between a monopole versus a dipole? Well, if it's oriented in the same position, it theoretically should operate very, very, very similarly, because the whole underlying theory is that you're creating a virtual second element below the radial. So on a virtual method, the only difference is your impedance should be approximately half that of a dipole. Instead of 76 in free space, it should be something more like 77, 78, 37 rather. But when you get close to the ground, those impedances shift anyway. So for all intents and purposes, depending upon how you angle the ground plane, you can adjust the impedances to be the 50 ohms that we know and love. I hope that's a sufficient answer.
I have some addition to that. So we have a vertical monopole and a vertical dipole. If the dipole, if we're talking about the dipole, we think about the dipole being fed from the middle. And that what is above the ground is one part of the dipole. The other one should be in the ground. So it's like an image. Approximately the same length. As far as monopole, exactly the same. The only thing is that we have a crown as a counterpoise. Back to you.
Okay, that's a physical difference, but I mean on a functional level. I thought you were kind of asking if there's a difference. But obviously, there's a physical difference between a one-element and a two-element antenna. One has one element and one has two elements. It's kind of inherent in the name.
So, remember, I started my first question from, can we make a counterpoise for a quarter wave antenna at 2 meters from the sheet of metal. So now let's go deeper to that subject, and we have an antenna that has a physical vertical antenna, monopole, that has a perfectly conducting ground. Usually the earth is a lossy conducting medium. Let's say we have a perfectly conducting one. How would the antenna know what length it should take from that to resonate at given frequency?
I do not know.
Want me to surprise you? I don't know either.
Okay, so we're both in agreement. It's a lot more complicated than that, unfortunately, because not only is it acting as a reflector, it's acting as a sink, as an absorber. So if it doesn't, if it has good conduction to ground potential, a lot of that energy, rather than being reflected, is being absorbed. So like most things in the real world, it starts to get very complicated.
I think I heard somebody wanted to say something.
This is Jim, KD2BHD. That was a great moment. It's an interesting topic you're talking about that I'm at the fringe of understanding. But the fact that you both didn't know and said so is profound, and I love it. Go on.
Okay, Jim, let me make sure I have the repeater. Okay. You will find, Jim, there is a lot of things that I don't know. If there is one thing I've learned a degree of wisdom on, is the older one gets and the wiser one hopefully gets, the better they appreciate all the things that they don't know. And there are things that guys with PhDs don't know, which surprised me when I was a youngster. I have a whole bunch of particularly weird physics questions, and in searching for answers found 300-page book to try and explain one particular guy's unproven theory of why the hell something happened. And it's not accepted by other people. So the whole understanding of science is not to know everything. That's a pointless effort. Is to try as best you can to improve your understanding of nature and modeling it as close to the way it seems to operate as humanly possible.
Basically, Jim.
Yes, Jeff.
I found that question of Wesley's very, very curious. It's an interesting question. And I'm not sure if I understand the question properly, let alone the answer. But it kind of springs to mind a similar question. Which way does the, how does the RF know which way to go? And the, like on a fan dipole, for example, the RF knows which way to go because the impedance is lowest there. So I think it stops doing what it has to do when it's satisfied its physical, the physical version of the virtual lobe. It's just a guess.
Okay, I mean, that's a possibility, but the conduction is longer. So what happens when it reaches the optimum length? It just reflects back, and that's the end of that. There's also, unfortunately, as I mentioned before, the fact that there's a significant amount of earth coupling, ground coupling, where the power is actually dissipated inside the earth as heat waste. So there's that complicating factor in addition to all the others.
Of course, agreed. Modeling it perfectly would be impossible. Of course, Wesley said it was perfect ground, so we could perhaps model it perfectly, as if it were a perfect system, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of simplifies things a little bit, but ultimately, even a perfect conductor is on ground, which is, even if you make the ground perfect conductor, it's still a point where a lot of your RF could just get soaked up and released as waste heat. Such. So, I mean, that's one of the many reasons why when you put up a vertical with radials on the ground, you have to plant a lot more radials than if you elevate them, because not only are you using the radials as a means to reflect your RF into a virtual second monopole, you're also shielding it from ground coupling that will draw the power down into the ground. So, you know, you have to keep those in mind as well. You know, there's only so much you can simplify a simplified model.
Roger, I love this conversation. AC2P.
Well, good, because I do too. That's why I come here every Sunday night to hopefully have these conversations.
Okay, let me go to the next one. It's related to the material that I sent you, but if you know by the chance, what is the depth of the biggest depth or deepest place in the ocean?
Didn't we have this conversation a month or two ago? We talked about the trough. There are some enormous pits in the ocean.
No, I'm trying to get to something else. That's to the related to the Veritas, not the Veritas, to the video that I have sent you about the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay, that's the one with the large collection of salt. I think the deepest portion of the ocean is the Mariana Trench, which, again, we talked about a while ago. But I think that's in the Pacific Ocean.
Right. So the deepest place is about 11 kilometers, 36,000 feet, 37,000 feet, I believe, something like that. And we have a situation where in 2013, BP had oil spill in that area, and geologists decided to get things into their hands. So they drilled deep in Gulf of Mexico, 1 mile, and they took the sample. So it's like an empty piece of pipe that is drilling inside of the rock, supposedly rock, right? And then they're taking that deposit and trying to analyze. But they find out it was salt. So they started to drill another mile. Nobody find out it was a salt. So they decided to drill another mile. But they find out it was a salt. So it is 30,000 feet. It's deeper than the deepest place in the ocean, the deposit of salt in the Gulf of Mexico. That happened. I don't know if you remember the video, but you.
Yeah, I saw it. I don't think I got to the end of it where the guy is explaining how ocean waters were feeding a certain place and there was a lot of evaporation. He was talking about his pot, how little salt you would recover from a pot full of seawater, the enormous amount of seawater necessary to extract that amount of salt in that thickness.
Yeah, about 200 to 160 million years ago, the land of Africa and South America was actually one with North America. But there was a trench. That was about 6,000 kilometers long crack that eventually made the North America and Gondwana, which is, Gulf of Mexico, it was called Pangea, right. So, to spread, and now we have a South of America and Africa over there. But because of a few miles wide crack, the water flow deposited the salt over there. And over those millions of years, we got 4.5 miles of salt there. 4.5 miles. So if you were drill to the solid rock, that would be the deepest place in the ocean. But
okay, I mean, earth science is fascinating. Tectonic plates are interesting. Apparently, although Pangea is kind of the most famous version of the continental drift colliding into one mega continent, I think most geologists tend to believe that there were other episodes where that had happened, not Pangea. But, the whole thing about tectonics actually, if you kind of sit there and look at maps, you get this weird impression, even before I learned about tectonics in elementary school, how continents seem to fit into each other. That kind of struck me rather early on in my awareness. So, it's a fascinating topic.
Yeah, a few facts before we go further. People were trying to get into the bottom and find out what is there, and there is a life there. So 1951, Challenger Deep, then there was the British ship Challenger 2. They went to the very bottom of Mariana Trench near Mariana Island, and that is 29,035 feet. They went there. But then the question is, what would you do if you have a lot of money, Dr. Roy?
I don't know. I never kind of play the what-if type of game. There's a lot of ways to waste money. There's a lot of ways to benefit other people with charitable donations for money. Sometimes it bites you on the backside. You know, William Gates, the famous Microsoft guy, you know, people have differing opinions. He donated a lot of money. He does a lot of charitable work. He gets a bit of grief. Sometimes it's warranted. He has a certain focus as a businessman of how to get things done in a very entrepreneurial